Hello, hello. It's Jacob Hill with GRC Academy. Today, I'm here with Mr. Stephen Molter. Stephen, how are you today?
I'm doing good, Jacob.
Good, good. Thank you so much for coming on. And folks, if you're enjoying the podcast, please take a moment to like, comment, share, subscribe, review. All the things helps me out. Thanks in advance. Steve, tell us about your background and how you got to where you are today.
Again, I'm Steve Molter. My friends call me Steve. I work with IntelliGRC. Got started in GRC and security, IT and engineering implementation, things like that. I went to a community college and didn't know what I wanted to do. But then I got an internship down in Richmond, Virginia, and they gave me an opportunity. Also, they introduced me to Active Directory, OU management, group policy, and things like that. I got my A+ certification, and then I started applying to jobs. I applied at Tiber Creek Consulting, which is the parent company of IntelliGRC. And I was a junior help desk and system administrator. Got a lot of awesome experience there. Have a lot of gratitude to give to them, allowing me to have that opportunity. Then that's where I got introduced to CMMC and the State 171, the need that they have for it as a DoD contractor. That's where I met our founder of IntelliGRC, Osman Saeed, or Ozzy Saeed, he likes to go by. And that's all she wrote.
What do you do today?
My role is to wear a lot of hats. I do a lot of functional work, helping with the development of IntelliGRC, not like the coding, but the requirements, especially from like an SME compliance perspective. What does the GRC platform need to be able to do? And what are the kind of nice to haves? And so that's part of my day to day. We have regular meetings and things like that I'm involved in. But recently, which is very related to our topic today, I've been doing a lot of implementation work, implementation, engineering, policy writing, procedure writing, checklist, SOPs, trying to hound people to, hey, to fill out that training attestation form, please. I need it for evidence and all this stuff. That's my day to day. I've been pretty much the majority is of my day just working on a customer's environment, trying to get them ready for an assessment or a POEM closeout if they had things left over from a previous assessment.
Okay, gotcha. What is IntelliGRC? You mentioned it. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so IntelliGRC is a software as a service GRC, governance, risk, compliance platform. The goal that we have is to make compliance simpler and to just try to help people understand what the requirements are while not having to have a ton of extra consulting fees on top of it, but they get a lot of that education. We have that partnership with you that we love so much, where our users are able to get your training. I have a training that I can do with them just to directly consult. We do services and things like that, but our core product is our SaaS platform. Our bread and butter is CMMC, NIST 800-171. But we also support things like some pre-built controls to satisfy the criteria for SOC 2. We have some pre-built controls that are related to the NIST 800-171 requirements for things like ISO 27001. And we've done a lot of work to try to do a lot of, we have a backbone meta framework, we call it, the ICL, the Intelli Control Library, that we just use to really reduce the amount of work that users that are assessing one framework need to do for the other framework. Now, it's not one-to-one, but if you complete a NIST 800-171 CMMC assessment, it's 60% of the way done assessing the controls that we've selected for ISO 27001. So you're saving a lot of time. And so that's our heart. We want to make it easier for people to get ready for an assessment, to understand the requirements, get their act together, and get a good SSP rolling.
Well, that's awesome. Today, we're talking mostly about the JSVA process. Tell us about that and first explain what is it?
Yeah, so the JSVA, or the Joint Surveillance Voluntary Assessment, is the current program that DCMA, in collaboration with C3PAOs, are doing to give OSCs, organizations seeking certification, an opportunity to get a DIPCAC High Assurance SPRS score. So it's still under the DFAR 7019-7020 concept of SPRS submission. And then obviously DFAR 7024, where the contracting officer considers that. It's still that high assurance SPRS, but it's giving those C3PAOs that are going to be the Lone Rangers under the CMMC program the experience and the assessment time and engagement, where OSCs can get their 110 score, Lord willing, if they actually can meet all the requirements, and then those C3POs get that experience. And then one of the things that was recently codified in the proposed rule was the rumor, or more than a rumor, it was more formal than a rumor, but it was never really written down anywhere from what I saw, but the idea that if you get 110 through the JSVA, it will convert into a actual CMMC certification for level 2. Thankfully, we got some clarification and hopefully that will stand when the final rule comes out. But that's that in short is the JSVA problem.
Great explanation. You mentioned C3POs and DCMA. How do you request a JSVA if you wanted one?
Yeah, the JSVA is requested mainly through the C3PO. There's a little bit of a caveat of a recent experience that we'll get into, I'm sure. But it's all the same. You go through a C3PAO saying, hey, I think I'm ready. And you contract with them. They talk about invoicing and all that stuff. And then they coordinate with DIPCAC, which is the DCMA DOD assessors, and get you on their schedule.
All right. Let's talk about DIPCAC and how they're structured. Tell us about that.
Yes. I've been part of a couple JSVAs now. And in the first JSVA that we did, which was one of the actual first JSVAs that had occurred, I don't know if it was the first one, but it was one of the first one. And you guys can go on our website and see an interview with the customer and that we helped get across the line, and with Amira Kiri, who was the assessor. It's all been published. It's okay to talk about, of course. DIPCAC was a little different. It was, from our understanding, it was pretty much just the small DIPCAC team that existed for the whole DOD. So they were doing their CAC high assurance assessments, as well as their C3PO assessment, and then their JSVA assessments, all kind of mishmash into one team. And we've got some information from pretty good sources that they've restructured. They had an explosion of employment. I think they're up to 250 members now or so. It used to be not that close, of course, to that. But now they've broken into three distinct specialized teams where there's a team that does the C3PO assessments to make sure that the C3POs are ready and they have stuff to be able to handle their OSC's evidence and things like that. And that's all based on 800-171, of course. And then there's a team that does the solo DIPCAC high assurance assessment like they did before. Then there's a team specifically set apart for the JSVA program. That is, their experience and their workflow is meant to work with the C3PO to assess an OSC and let the C3PO take the reins. From my understanding, that is the current structure of the DIPCAC team inside of DCMA.
Working at a GRC company as you do, you're seeing your customers go through this process. Tell us about some of the things you've seen that are interesting.
Yes, I think one of the big things that we've noticed across the JSVAs that we've worked on, they don't look the same. Obviously, there's several factors included in that. There's the fact that it's different C3POs. You're dealing with human beings that have their interpretations and their logical workflows that they're thinking through, their biases and their background. I'm not using bias in a bad way. I'm saying that they're coming with experience that another C3PO and their assessment team would not have, right? So there's that. And you're also dealing with precedent, things being set over time. And so one of the differences that we've seen is that there's an understanding and there's a workflow and requirements and there's expectations that may have not been required back 2 years ago when the JSVA kind of was kicked off and was underway and where we got our first set of experience, right? It's different now. And there's precedent and there's the CIO memo about FedRAMP equivalency. And there's a lot of things happen over time. One of the big interesting things is that the JSVAs do not look the same. And coming into an assessment where you're like me, I'm essentially acting on their behalf, representing them. They don't talk at all. I'm doing all the talking. I can't expect the same thing every time. And I've seen this now, and it does affect the assessment. Like I said before, there was no really separation of duties between the different DIPCAC teams. Really, they all worked together and they were all coming from RMF and they were all coming from just assessing from a DOD perspective without the input of the commercial world. And now we have these separate teams, like I said, that we've seen in DIPCAC. And one of the experiences that is most applicable to this is one of our recent JSVAs. One of the examples of how this kind of played out and affected the assessment was the company that we were working with actually didn't voluntarily go through the assessment. They were selected by DIPCAC for one of those DIPCAC high assurance assessments. So the team that was assigned to this company was that team that their experience is DOD only focused high assurance assessments without the input of a C3PO. That was that team. And they were given a very short timeline to get ready. And they had a lot still to work on. They still had a lot to implement. And they were trying to figure things out. They were honest in their SPRS, but they wanted to get things done. And with the proposed rule and the drama related to AF-171 Rev 3, like all the things that were happening, one of the things that was recommended to them is they wanted to take advantage of the JSVA program. And so they consulted with a see-through PO. The see-through PO went to DIPCAC, and DIPCAC acquiesced to a request to convert the DIPCAC high assurance assessment into a JSVA. The OSC would be able to have a HOAM closeout period for all controls. The CMFC proposed rule isn't final yet. They wanted to take advantage of the fact that if they didn't have a single control implemented, they had half a year essentially to implement all of the controls after the assessment, and then still be eligible for the CMFC certification that would come after the proposed rule is final. That was one thing that affected the assessment, was we have the DIPCAC high assurance team sitting in on the JSVA. So one of the first things we saw was between the DIPCAC teams and even the different experiences with the different C3POs is there's a lot of subjectivity and liberty taken to the interpretation of the controls. And so one of the things we saw up front, and they were very vocal about, for better or for worse, was that they are coming with their experience from, and not even a Department of Defense RMF, but just RMF across other federal agencies too. Obviously, DIPCAC is DOD, but the C3PO had other RMF experience. That really affected some of the experience that we had helping companies implement things. Again, I learned a lot, honestly, from the C3PO and from the DIPCAC team's perspective. But again, it was just different. It was not the same.
If I'm understanding correctly, the DIPCAC team, who only does involuntary DIPCAC high assessments, they stayed on to work with the C3PAO on the JSVA. Is that right?
Correct. They did not pass it on to the JSVA team.
Oh, okay. I see. Interesting.
I don't want to sound negative, but it was like we were stuck with the DIPCAC high perspective and their concerns. Again, they're accepting the risk for the CIO, right? They're standing in this, that they have a responsibility. So I understood where they were coming from, but it was a different set of experience that led them to different conclusions so that they could address those risks and make those determinations. I think the next point that was interesting was, obviously, like I said earlier, there was a development over time. We got that Christmas present of the CMFC proposed rule being dropped, and there's a lot of content in there. There are things about security protection data. There are things about this relationship between ESPs and CSPs and all those different things that we could have a whole separate conversation about. That affected this assessment because there was one particular control, 3120, where you're talking about interconnections, right? And we're dealing with the relationship between cloud service providers and the different asset categorizations for them. And in the proposed rule, the tone is set that security protection data needs to be protected pretty much at the same level that CUI data itself needs to be protected. Now, a lot of arguments, and again, I don't want to get into that, but that was one thing. So one of the speculations is that the assumption is going to be that all security protection assets that are cloud-based are probably going to need to be FedRAMP themselves, right? Not just CUI assets, even though even the proposed rule doesn't say that. And the proposed rule and DFAR 7012 doesn't say that. And DFAR 7010 doesn't say that, or at least in the relationship between security protection asset. What occurred was when we came to that control for 3120, initially that was a nonconformity, was the fact that we were using a certain security protection asset product for authentication. We were not using the FedRAMP version of that product. I had to go to bat for the company and say, look, that's not a requirement. You're adding a requirement that is a legitimate, logical conclusion from the details we're getting from some of these documents. But currently, what you're assessing against is 7012. Yes, you're using the CAP, the assessment protocol, right? But that's not in there. That's not the requirement. And thankfully, they acquiesced. But that was one of those kind of items that was like, oh, wait, there's a lot of influence from things that aren't directly tied to the requirements that we understood we needed to be ready to be assessed against. We've got to be really careful about the way we tread over the next few days, answering some of these questions and trying to help get them across the finish line. So that was one of those things.
It's an interesting problem too, because you alluded to this, the C3PAO had identified that as a finding, but the training for assessors is not yet up to date with the program rule that was released and more recent items as well. So it's an interesting problem. Like you said, there is a lot of subjectivity out there.
Yeah, it was sheerly based off of the proposed rule and the subsequent memo that came out, right? there was nothing else that it could have been based off of. And the C3PO referenced the proposed rule as one of the rationales for it. That's when that discussion happened about, this isn't a requirement yet. You can't find us for that, right? At least for a security protection asset, totally for a CUI asset. It has to be FedRAM. We agree. Another factor that was interesting about the experience, I say interesting because this was all beneficial, right? This was experience building. This is something to help me understand the future and how to help better in the future. But we had the involvement of an MSP added into the picture. In previous JSVA experience, we didn't have an MSP to try to work that relationship out with. It was much simpler when it was just one entity. We at IntelliGRC were acting as users of the entity, and we had a laptop from them. We were licensed with Microsoft 365 G5 license. We were a company user, right? An OSC authorized user, right? With this MSP involvement, that did not work the same. If you know anything about MSPs, you know, you're dealing with RMM tools, right? You're dealing with external identity interconnections with Microsoft Entra, even in a GCC environment, right? You're dealing with things that objectively create interconnections, especially with the level of access, authority, and privilege that an MSP has. It's a concern. That was one of the things that really affected the assessment was, okay, the MSP needs to be assessed as a security protection asset in the same way that every other system component that is subject to the 800.171 requirements need to be assessed. And so it's, how do we go about making sure that you can share your screen and you can share your screen and, oh, show us what you see on your side in your portal. And, oh, do you have your policies, your procedure, like all these different things that before you don't think about when you're just dealing with a solo company that just needs a hand getting things implemented. And then they have somebody that can take over and keep things going, which we've seen in the past. It just was so different. And so that was the last piece of the puzzle. And if any advice that I can give to people in the DIV right now that are thinking through this and how they're going to implement it, is really think long and hard about your MSP. Think long and hard about how you want them to be involved in your environment, especially if you have an enclave. Is there a world where they also act as an authorized user using only you issue them a device and them not use their devices, especially if you're a smaller business and have a smaller subset of users in an enclave or something like that? There are ways that you can simplify this to where what we went through and struggled through won't be as rigorous, right? You won't have to worry so much. You still have to worry about them doing the trainings as an authorized user, as a security personnel needing to do those trainings and all the different things that come with having somebody in your environment as an authorized user. You still have to deal with that, but it's much simpler if they're not an interconnection, definitionally.
This MSP discussion is very interesting, and yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about it. What would you expect from the MSP so that the DIB contractor can be successful when it comes time for the assessment?
Depending on the way you engage with them, if they're going to act as a user on your environment, or if you're going to use them as an interconnection, they have their laptops and workflows and RMM tools and all those different things that they host and manage, and they truly are a totally isolated company and organization and information system that's interconnecting with yours, there's a lot that you have to expect, right? You have to expect them to know, first off, we can start from the very first control. Like, do they have an inventory of personnel who are authorized to access your environment? Are they keeping track of that kind of thing? Do they have an authorization process? Assuming that a C3PO would want to see this, I've not seen that, and that wasn't asked, but assuming that would happen, can they produce an authorization checklist or approval and then an inventory of those people, right? Can they acquiesce to giving a body of evidence for their environment? This is the whole reason why if an ESP is going to handle security protection data or CUI data, they need to have CUC certification under the proposed rule. That's the whole point. But one of the things that comes into play is, and I know that this isn't specifically hardcore spelled out and regulated in a specific way, but I would not engage with a JSVA process without your MSP having an SRM documented, a shared responsibility matrix documented, and the details from that being at least referenced in your SSP. That is a big one. It's like a combination of those two things. Can they prove that their information system, at least the portion of it that's engaging with your information system, just as compliant, right? Equivalent to the measures that are laid out in 800.171. And do they have the documentation to let you know what they're responsible for? And is that reflected in your SSP?
Yeah, great advice. An MSP might sound like an easy button, right? From an IT perspective, but man, from a compliance perspective, it opens up all kinds of potential issues. Pick selectively, folks. It's really important. Let's move on then to lessons learned. You gave a great story about that experience with the DIPCAC team and the CCRPO and some of the struggles based off of that. What do you think are the lessons learned from that?
Yeah, you kind of touched on it when I was talking about it. If you're a div company, I'm giving advice to you. One thing I'm going to say from the get-go is understand where you're at with the requirement. If you're a company, which it's okay, we're busy people. You have to run a company. You have things to do. You've got task orders to fulfill, like purchase orders, all these different things that you got to take care of to keep your business going. You might not have time to be an expert in NIST 100-171, DPAR 7012, and all the things that are coming and all the likes. So when you're working with consultancies and then ultimately a C3PAO, be honest with yourself about where you're at and then understand their background. But if you're not super familiar with the requirements or don't have a background, you're just trying to run your business and you happen to do work for the government and that kind of been your niche, but you're a shop, be careful about the C3PAO that you work with. Understand the background of the people you're working with. And that's not just the C3PAOs or even DIPCAC. Just understand the backgrounds of the people you're working with. And be wise and don't put extra burden on yourself by selecting a C3PO or a consultant or whoever may be a lot more rigid and a lot more focused on a certain mindset when it comes to implementation.
Those are great points. Another thing I would mention is depending on what environment you're working in, if it's manufacturing, definitely where you get someone who's familiar with that environment. I know
yes.
There are folks who even worked in manufacturing themselves who are now C3POs. Or at least CMMC assessors, if I'm not mistaken. Those are the folks to go to, definitely do your research. Let's move on then to DIPCAC. Tell us the lessons learned based off of working with them.
I don't want to ever come across negative. I know that this is a stressful industry. This is people's jobs and businesses on the line. I know that can come with the territory. But one of the pieces that might look that way is DIPCAC has their set of experience. Like I said before, a lot of them are very well versed in RMF, working with ATOs, and they don't know CMMC very well. They don't know the struggles and pain points of the world and DIB organizations and mom and pop shops and developers that work for the government. And they might not understand their struggles and they might not really understand things like the assessment guides, scoping guides, and things like that. That was super apparent to me, is that they might have not spent as much time with those documents as I have, whereas I have not spent nearly as much time with NIST RMF documents and workflows, engineering plans, and all the things that they are probably very intimate with. That is one of the considerations when it comes to mentally preparing for engaging with DIPCAC. I just don't think they know CMMC and all the conversations that C3POs, like at the C3PO stakeholder forum and things like that, are having. And that will affect scoping, that will affect the outcome of an implementation. Just as an example, there were things that the C3PO considered implemented that DIPCAC did not, and vice versa. And I'll give an example of this. There's a group of controls that are very related in the access control and the system communication protection family, and that's all about encryption of data at rest. One of the requirements, not just at rest, but CUI being encrypted in general. 31311, 31316, and 31119 all kind of touch on the same thing and will have very similar implementations. They at least will include some of the same content. And the MSP was totally on board with our implementation. To be specific, the MSP was not anywhere to be found in the 313 requirement, where we talk about the flow of CUI. They were not authorized to access it. Nothing to do with CUI. And they passed us, both the C3PO and DIPCAC passed us on that control. They accepted our UI data flow diagram and our narrative, and they accepted obviously our SSP. We had no problems with 313. But what they didn't like was, because of the level of access that the MSP with their own machines and their own environment had as an interconnection to the system, even though they were not authorized or approved to do it, the fact that we were not able to prove in that moment because of evidence and there was coordination of the MSP being available and things like that, we were not able to prove that the MSP's endpoints were BitLockered. with FIPS 140-2 registry key enabled BitLocker. That was a finding for us in this particular assessment, was because the MSP was not there to prove on this particular instance.
So that was against 313.11 CUI encryption. Is that where that finding came in?
It wasn't just 313.11. It was 313.16 and 3.1.19 because, you know, we're talking about laptops, we're talking about data at rest, and then we're talking about CUI in general being encrypted. And it was like the logic from DIPCAC was, well, they have so much access in this environment. I mean, they're global admins. They could do what they wanted in a sense. There was the potential for them to access the UI and exfiltrate it to their environment or something like that, even though they accepted our data flow diagram and they accepted our, you know, all the different things. But yeah, what you just said, those were the findings, was 313.11. And I tried to stand my ground on it. I tried to go to bat for the company and be like, no, you accepted our data flow diagram and that they're not authorized on there. They don't have CUI. They will never have CUI. It's not authorized. And if we find out that they do have CUI, we're going to kill the contract and there's going to be sanctions and things like that. Like, we have an agreement for this very reason, and that it just didn't fly. They don't want to have it. So I, you know, had to draft up an MOU. I had to do all this other stuff. And what ultimately ended up happening was we issued them laptops owned and managed by the company so that we could show unequivocal isolation, and they just became not an interconnection anymore. They became actual users in the system. That's one of the scary things. There's a lot of companies that use MSPs. And I would assume for the most part, a lot of the MSPs are not working hard towards implementing NIST 800-171 or being ready for CMMC. This particular MSP actually is. It's just they've got work to do just like all of us do. And so it was one of those things that it was just easier to make a logical workflow that we'll then readdress when the time comes that they're ready to actually be added as an interconnection again and have their ducks in a row. It was just easier to let their devices be assets in the inventory and their actual organizational users and devices at that point.
Was the C3PAO and DIPCAC, were they on the same page with this finding?
So no, that was the interesting part. And this is kind of going back to what I said earlier about DIPCAC not knowing CMMC as well as obviously the C3PAOs do. The C3PAO was totally on board. They understood, they agreed. It wasn't until the debriefing where we realized, oh, we did not pass this control. That was one of those examples where the C3PAO marked it as met, where DIPCAC did not. They marked it as other than satisfied.
That's quite a story. Well, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. Where can people find you?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me, Stephen Wolter, or Cog in the Compliance Machine, as I might call myself sometimes. And you can always go check us out at IntelliGRC.com. IntelliGRC is on LinkedIn as well, so you can follow us there.
Thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.